All right. Thank you so much.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here this morning. Before I introduce our illustrious speaker, I wanted to note some changes on our schedule for the rest of the year. First of all, as I mentioned last month, we're very excited to have Rabbi Moshe Targan from Yeshivat Har Tzion Gush come and be our Shavuot Scholar in Residence together. That is a program that's going to be jointly sponsored by Midrash Yom Rishon and Kollel Yom Rishon, so please stay tuned for those details. It's going to be wonderful, God willing. I'm also very excited to inform you all that Dr. Erica Brown will be our speaker in May, on May 1st. So you'll notice that there's going to be a slight change to our schedule. Miriam Krupka, which was our May speaker, will be coming next month, March 26th, and then March 27th, excuse me. May 1st, Dr. Brown will be here, and in her honor, I don't know how many of you saw, but David Brooks recently at the New York Times wrote a whole op-ed article about her. She is a very sought-after speaker, and we were very fortunate to be getting her here. So in honor of her coming, we're going to be having a special Midrash Yom Rishon on May 1st. It's going to be a program from 10 to 12 involving independent group study, independent group text study, and obviously a shiur by Dr. Brown. So we hope you will all join us on that date as well. And on to our illustrious speaker this month, Mora Atara Ice. Atara Ice is a superstar who teaches Limudei Kodesh at Kohelet Yeshiva High School right across the street, and she works as Yuetzet Halacha for many synagogues in Manhattan. After graduating Stern College, she studied in YU's graduate program for advanced Talmudic studies and received her master's in Jewish education from the Azrieli Graduate School. While studying in Yerushalayim for 2 years to become a Yuetzet Halacha at Nishmat, she worked at Midreshet Lindebaum. She and her husband, Rabbi Rafi Ice, live in Baal Kinwood, where they raise their three children. Thank you, Atara.
Thank you so much, Orit and Tal and Yoni. I wanted to just dedicate our learning this morning for a Refuah Shelema for a beautiful, tiny little preemie named Be'er Yaakov Ben Emuna. And Le'iloi Nishmat, his brother, Kalev Ezra ben Zacharia, may his neshama have a full aliyah. I also want to mention before I begin that the bulk of what I'm presenting here, I studied when I was in Stern College under the advisement of Professor Ephraim Kannerfogel, so I'm very much indebted to his guidance in this process. And I also want to mention that the translations of the Kuzari that you have before you are from the translation of Rabbi Karabkin from Los Angeles. He has a phenomenal new translation of the Kuzari, which is much better than the very difficult to understand old English one that was popular for many years. So, okay. So if we look through the history of Jewish thought and we try to figure out how we got where we are today, it's interesting to look for those moments where there were tiny shifts and where tiny shifts end up making very big changes. Rarely do we see some kind of massive change, and when we do, most often, that is the sign that such a movement is probably not going to survive as an authentic expression of Judaism. In the Middle Ages, that was a very important time where a tiny little change set the course of Jewish thought to follow in a very different direction. Many had gotten very comfortable with the rationalism with which we most associate the Rambam, Chastai ibn Kreskas and Rav Haigaon, very typical rationalists. And they embraced many aspects, the Rambam in particular, of Aristotelian thought, and they attempted to put belief in God into entirely rational terminology, to find philosophical and rational proofs for the existence of God and see Judaism in that way. But many grew restless, and they had difficulty accepting such an approach. One such individual was the Ramban, and the truth is that he seemed to follow in the footsteps of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi more than he followed in the footsteps of the Rambam. He tends to quote the Rambam much more often, but we're going to see today that, truthfully, if we want to see a kindred spirit to Ramban's thought, we really should look at Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. And in fact, in the 19 letters, Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch identified why he sees these two thinkers as similar. If you look at the first source on the page, they were of the very few who stood with their intellectual investigations completely within Judaism and built the interpretation of Judaism entirely upon its own premises. Okay? And the truth is that Rav Hirsch, in the 19 letters, was in the process of lamenting how Jews over the ages have very often misinterpreted the spirit of Judaism. And they're always looking outside of Judaism, mostly to philosophy, either as an alternative or as a force deserving of reconciliation or synthesis with Jewish thought. And this seemed to bother Rav Hirsch, and that's why he commends Ramban and Rabbi Yehuda Levi for withstanding this tendency, and he saw them as very significant voices in the trajectory of his own thought as he sought to find what he considered the authentic voice of Judaism. So the question is he right? Right? What is the commonality between Halevi and Ramban? And he sees them as these indigenous, always internal sources. What we want to explore today is that true? Are they really exclusively people who looked internally and didn't feel the need to look externally? And this exploration, I believe, has tremendous practical ramifications for our day and age. When does a shift in Jewish thought, whether theological or halachic or in any way, when does it stick? When is it significant? And how do we model our own choices as a community after these two figures? So Halevi, who died in 1141, was popularly known as the anti-philosopher philosopher. And he was very involved in Jewish philosophy, in poetry, in theology, and a little bit in mysticism. And the truth is he didn't have much to do with halacha. Apparently he had one thing to do with like determining the date line. But beyond that, he really didn't make a mark in halacha. And perhaps, though, recent scholars, more in the academic world, have suggested that he's not as anti-philosophical as he seems. His famous philosophical dialogue is called the Kuzari. The subtitle is A Book in Defense of the Despised and Humiliated Faith. And in that, we have it. What's so wonderful about it is it's that it's a dialogue. You have the Chaver, who is a Rav, who triumphantly portrays Judaism as the ultimate revealed religion, rejecting other religions. And the person who he is talking to is the king of the Khazars. And even halfway through the dialogue, he convinces the Melech HaKozarim to convert to Judaism, but they still go on. They have a lot to talk about. The Chaver, if you look at face value at the book, seems to very harshly critique what has become known as the Spanish Andalusian culture, with which Halevi seemed to be quite familiar. However, some recent scholarship by a professor named Yohanan Silman sees that they're actually, based on some research, some archaeological evidence, it seems that actually the Kuzari was written in two phases. And if you look at the first phase of his thought, he actually is much more philosophical. He actually seems to accept a lot of the philosophy of the time. And in the second phase of his thought, he seems to reject a lot of it. But what's interesting is that you would think that if he's rejected it, wouldn't he just take it out of his book? Why would he leave it in? Why would he leave evidence of the early phases of his thought inside? So we have to look and see why he would do that. And the interesting thing is that if you look at a lot of the academics, they actually tend to look, as opposed to Rav Hirsch and we, who tend to look at Halevi as very internal, academics are always looking to find all this outside influence upon Halevi. In fact, in the 20th century, a lot of scholars detected that there's a lot of Sufi mystic influence upon his thought. There's this phenomenal work by a woman named Diana Lobel, where she shows how really the Kuzari reads as if it's a Sufi mystic manual, which was not uncommon. The Chovot HaLevavot of Rabbi Bachya Ibn Pakuda also was similar. And that, of course, if you think about that, well, then what was Rav Hirsch saying? How could it be that this is such an internal work if he's actually using a format which was very popular in the general culture of the time? So the other thing is that, I mean, if we see him as this, you know, someone who starts to bring the mystical tendency and thing, we know the Rambam was very, very anti-mysticism. Anytime there was something that seemed mystical, he found a way to interpret it in a philosophical way. So the question is, what exactly was his relationship towards mysticism, and what affected his mystical thought? Because, of course, if you're seeing Sufi mystic influence upon his mystical thought, and we tend to think of mysticism as being, oh, something very internal, as opposed to something influenced by the outside, what does that say about his mysticism? So recently, scholars have talked about just how influential Halevi is in general upon Jewish thought, and they've traced his actual words in 13th century Kabbalah, 14th and 15th century anti-rationalism, the 15th century Italian Renaissance, the 18th century Hasidut, and beyond. Gershom Scholem, the famous academic who's one of the main academics on Kabbalah, says, in my opinion, there's a direct connection between Yehuda Halevi, the most Jewish of Jewish philosophers, this is the second quote on the sheet, and the Kabbalists. For the legitimate trustees of his spiritual heritage have been the mystics and not the succeeding generations of Jewish philosophers. So on the one hand, one of the things that he does in the Kuzari, and the part that is probably most skipped, is an analysis of Sefer Yetzirah, which is a mystical treatise talking about the creation of the world based on the 22 letters of the alphabet. And the truth is, as we're going to see, he actually has a lot of reservations about whether it was actually authentic and whether it's something that is worth having a comment on. But he spends a lot of time, maybe too much time, giving his interpretation of the Sefer Yetzirah. And the truth is, he himself was kind of wondering whether it was worth preserving, but my father believes that that actually the fact that he even talks about it and questions it actually popularized it. Everyone was like, ooh, what's that Sefer Yetzirah? And one of the most important individuals in Kabbalah, Rav Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, actually, according to my father, has explicit references to the terminology of the Kuzari. So just the fact that even though he was saying, I don't really think the Sefer Yetzirah is so important, but then he puts it in his book, and then future Kabbalists read that and say, huh, and they feel that it is something to contend with, shows that whether he wanted to or not, he had a tremendous influence upon the moving forward of Kabbalah. So now to start talking about Ramban a little bit. So Ramban has always been considered a conservative Kabbalist. And we think of him as a Kabbalist, but the truth is that if you compare his Kabbalistic thought to other Kabbalists, whether those at the same time as him or certainly those who come after him, he was pretty tame if you compare him. So it would be interesting if we see that Halevi himself was kind of a little concerned as to what makes it as mystical and what doesn't. It would be interesting to see how indebted he is how indebted Ramban is to Halevi. A little bit of facts about Ramban, so just we're on the same page. So Ramban lived later. He lived from 1194 to 1270, right? So he was after the Rambam, after the Halevi, who was even before the Rambam. And he, as opposed to Halevi, who didn't really have much to do with Halacha or Gemara, we think of Ramban, I mean, most of us might think of his parish on the Torah, which we cannot learn Tanakh without Ramban, but he was a master Talmudist. He was a biblical exegete, he was a Kabbalist, and one of the interesting things that he did was he was involved in the Jewish-Christian polemics, so he was a disputant. And he, perhaps, I mean, if we think of him, he was probably the most important Jewish intellectual figure in the 13th century in Christian Spain. And he, the way that he kind of inherited a lot of different traditions, both the Spanish influence and the Ashkenazic influence, taking Rashi and Tosfot and all of the Ashkenazim, and also being someone who inherited Ibn Ezra and more Spanish people, and additionally being involved in the most elite group of Kabbalists who were getting their work done in Gerona. So he was seriously a very important individual. The way that he manages to synthesize the more the Pshat tradition, which we normally associate with the Spanish culture, and the more Drash tradition, which we associate clearly, obviously, with Rashi, and his deep understanding of Midrash. A lot of people say that it was actually his involvement in Kabbalah that allowed him to create this beautiful synthesis, and hopefully we'll see examples of that. So a lot of people compare the Ramban to Rambam, and as I mentioned before, Ramban himself, who does he quote? He quotes Rambam all the time, very often to reject the Rambam, but it's very clear that he cared a lot about what the Rambam has to say. And interestingly enough, it's not clear, even though the Rambam came after the Kuzari, it's not clear that he ever read any of Halevi's work. He never makes references to him. He never talks about him. And Ramban makes very, very few references to the Kuzari. We'll see an example or two. Maybe one, actually. And so where it's clear that Halevi read, that the Ramban read the Kuzari, it's not clear exactly how much, directly or indirectly, Halevi influenced his thought. So the title of the class is called Rebels from Within the Tradition, or, you know, Rebels from Within, and that's based on a line from a professor, Yitzhak Be'er, who says that that Halevi can be seen as a kindred spirit to Ramban, as they both pose as rebels from within the Andalusian tradition. Ironically, as rebels, they're more rejecting the rationalism as opposed to, you know, when we think of rebels nowadays, we're like, oh, people who say that it's too experiential, not enough rationalism. So it's interesting to see how things have changed. All right, so let's start looking at what makes these two people in common. So again, as I mentioned, and by the way, I'll just give you an overview of what we're going to do. We're going to see the similarity. You see, I wrote down overview. The similar approaches that they have toward mysticism and philosophy. We're going to see an example of where Halevi is stuck and doesn't know how to hold on a certain issue, while Ramban seems to be freed by that very issue, in that very issue. And we're going to see a very important area of divergence where their thought diverges. And again, we'll see that Ramban really sets the history forward for how things are approached. Okay, so as I mentioned, there's this scholarship of Professor Yohanan Silman where he sees the two stages of thought. The first stage, as I wrote here, is in, by the way, the Kuzari is four sections, there are four parts of the Kuzari. So within the first section, there's just a small amount, basically paragraph 68 through 79, which is longer than you think it is. It's not just short little paragraphs. You could go on for like pages in a paragraph. In the second section, there are 1 through 7, and all of section 3 of the Kuzari seem, based on this archaeological evidence, to be early thought Halevi. So if you look at his early thought in the left column, I brought two examples of his thought, where it's clear that that Halevi seems to be accepting some of the benefit, the tenets of Aristotelian philosophy. He sees God as intellect. What that really means, if someone could explain it to me, I'd really appreciate it. We also call God wise of heart because he is the essence of intelligence and intelligence itself. Okay? And in the third part of the Kuzari, in paragraph 53, he says, your death is only the decay of your body, whereas the soul, having reached this step, cannot descend from it or be removed. So, first of all, just the first comment, it seems very clear that, you know, if God is intelligence and man is intelligent, then God in some way is entirely knowable to humans. And in the third part, we see that he's saying, okay, the material body seems to end, but the spirit seems to go on. I think a lot of people might be saying, yeah, what's so strange about that? Don't our bodies die and then our souls go on forever? I mean, isn't that normal to believe? Actually, those who are familiar with Ramban know that he actually thinks that some kind of spiritualized body ends up going on into Olam Haba, and not just the neshama. Okay, so we see this idea of God as being intellect. If you think that God is intellect, then the concept of having to have a revelation of God in this world is less important. And the only reason that we have to do mitzvot is to resemble God, God who is intellect. And it's a little bit of a rational, kind of limited view of God. But there are a lot of problems with this kind of approach toward toward life in general, which seems to be very much, again, impacted by Aristotelian universalism. And in his later thought, Halevi gets very into kind of going beyond these two approaches here, because he has some issues. He says, first of all, right, if God is just intellect and humans can know the God's intellect and all that, then why does B'nai Yisrael have to have a unique destiny? And why does there need to be revelation? Why did Hashem reveal through this big sound and light show, if all we need to do is just think, and if we're thinkers, then we know God. Additionally, if God is all just about intellect, then why are my individual actions important, right? I don't know why things are more significant when I as a human do them. And third of all, what is the point of any kind of religious experience if all we have to do is sit and think about God? So these are the kinds of things which pushed him in his later thought to think of God not as just intellect, but as something radically transcendent, and seeing and stressing the fact that man's intellect is very, very limited. And that's why he rejects, ultimately, a completely logic-based philosophy. It could not possibly be the ultimate truth because it's just too limiting of an approach. There's recently Rav Yuval Sherlow from Israel put out a close to 600-page book on Shir HaShirim. Yeah. So thank God Rabbi Chaim Angel, Professor Chaim Angel, summarized it in 10 pages in tradition. But he says you really have to read the whole thing if you want the full impact. And Chaim Angel mentions that Rav Sherlow says that that the Kuzari seems to have been proven correct over time. That although he very much shows that one of the points that the Kuzari wants to show is that philosophy does not contradict the Torah. That doesn't mean that everything can be demonstrated rationally. You can't just live your life based on reason. And that Halevi was the one to kind of come up with this approach and send Jewish thought in this direction. And in his later thought, the Kuzari focused on how Hashem reveals himself to man through prophecy, right, revelation, and through history. Who is Hashem? Look in the first box of the late thought in part one of the Kuzari, right? Hashem is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who took the Jews out of Egypt with great wonders and miracles, who sustained them in the desert, who gave them the land of Canaan as their inheritance. In other words, that there's something more about the experience of God, of and not just, you know, we identify God not as the one who created the world, but as someone who's continuously in the lives of humanity, which is why Rav Sherlow also comments that whereas the Rambam's faith seems to be much more based on Bereishit, Rav Soloveitchik is much more based on Shir HaShirim. We can do a whole other shir on that. Halevi's faith was clearly based on the experiences of Sefer Shmot. He's a Sefer Shmot man. And so again, if we could explore that, that's a shir in itself. So just some more quotes about the personal experience of man and how that's so significant. Later on part one, paragraph 25, the whole of Israel knew these things first from personal experience and afterwards through uninterrupted tradition, which is equal to the former. So we sitting here in 2011, since we are recipients of this uninterrupted tradition, that is equal to the personal experience that they had in the Midbar. And in part four, he talks about don't think you're so wise that you can get everything, that you can understand all metaphysical problems, that everything can be proven. He goes on and says, I now understand the great distance between the God of Abraham and the God of Aristotle. We cannot just be Aristotelian Jews. And in five, he again expresses the fact that we cannot fully understand the soul. There's something beyond us. There's something that can't just be grasped and understood in this world. And it would be a defect in him if we could grasp his nature. So God is transcendent as opposed to something that's knowable in this world. On the other hand, he never fully abandons rationalism, because these two, by the way, I should mention that not everyone accepts Silliman's theory. Not everyone says, oh, there were two phases of thought. But I think, I mean, after I read it, his work, I think it's pretty convincing to me, but you can make your own decisions. But even in his later thought, what Silliman considers his later thought, he makes sure to mention that the Torah never expects us to believe in things contradicted by evidence or proofs. Okay, so there's still a little bit. It's not that the Torah is not rational. It's just that it's not exclusively rational, and that never does the Torah write something that logic dictates as false. So although his abandonment of the Aristotelian philosophy seems to be more crucial than his initial acceptance of it, this initial acceptance does show, perhaps modifying Rav Hirsch's statement, that at one point he actually thought that philosophy did deserve reconciliation. And also, at this time, the idea of sense perception and of experience was also very common in the philosophical sphere. They were themselves moving away from this purely intellectual, logical approach toward God. In the Arabic philosopher of Avicenna. Okay, and perhaps that could have influenced Halevi's thought as well. So there still, though, is a very big distance between a secondary acceptance of reason as a capable tool and an entire overhaul of Rav Hirsch's statement. It's not that Halevi is trying to fit Judaism into philosophy. No, that's not his approach. But he does allow the acceptance of philosophy as long as he's firmly planted within the Jewish camp. So one, I mentioned at the beginning that it seems very strange that if he rejected this early thought and he no longer thought that rationalism had any kind of serious, that Judaism didn't need to be explained in a completely rational way, the question is, why does he leave those early thought pieces in? So my father what I think is a very compelling idea, that even in those new sections, and by the way, it's always that he has the king of the Khazars, right, the Melech HaKhazarim, asking these questions asking these rational-tinged questions. So my father suggests that maybe that's kind of Halevi's mouthpiece for saying, I'm not fully comfortable abandoning rationalism. So he kind of leaves it in, and again, the writing it as a dialogue gives him this room to kind of leave it in as a mouthpiece for perhaps a few of the questions that remained with him. So even though he knows that Judaism doesn't need to be fully reconciled with philosophy because Judaism is Judaism, at the same time, perhaps he hasn't fully recovered from what he initially thought. So now just to talk about mysticism for a minute. Again, I mentioned before that a lot of people assume that mysticism is completely indigenous and had no outside influence. But again, I mentioned before that the Sufi mystic language that seems to be used, by the way, the Khuzari was originally written in Arabic, which is why I didn't even bother to bring it in Hebrew, because that in itself is a translation. So I might as well go to the other translation. And again, so what does that do for Rav Hirsch's statement? So the truth is that when Halevi uses a mystical term, what he's trying to do is say, yeah, we got that, and better, right? To use the terms that the people of the time were used to, that they were in touch with, that they saw in the outside world, because after all, we're talking about the Sephardic community here. We're not talking about the Ashkenazic community at the time, which was much more insular, didn't have much to do with the outside. But the Sephardim, they were very much involved in what was called the Golden Age of Spain, and they were in dialogue. They were talking with people who weren't Jewish. So the fact that he was able to use those terms was actually a pretty smart move on his part. It's similar to a lot of popular organizations nowadays, which are trying to show the beauty of Yiddishkeit. They'll use a lot of wonderful advertising techniques that are used in the outside world. There are a more insular approach toward Judaism, they're using those tactics. They're trying to show how philosophy, how psychology has so many, that Judaism has such a beautiful approach towards psychology and has a deep understanding of psychology. And they'll use those terminologies because they'll relate to the people that they are writing to. And that doesn't mean that they are Sufi mystics, it means that they're smart. It means that they're using terminology that the people they're talking to will understand. So now to move on to Ramban a little bit. A lot of people assume that Ramban was clueless when it comes to philosophy, but it's actually not quite true. The scholars try to say that even if he did have a layperson's understanding of philosophy, he was pretty good at it. He knew what he was doing. And a famous example of it, and for the sake of time, I'm probably just going to read the English, but I did bring the Hebrew as well, is on his first comment on the entire Torah in Bereishit, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, when he's talking about defining what, actually in Pasuk Bet, Tohu and Vohu are. You know, the land was Tohu Vavohu. He actually uses a Greek philosophical term to explain what Tohu Vavohu was. And as we know, Aristotelians didn't believe that the world ever started. Thank God, even your average scientist nowadays believes that the world started at some point, even if they don't understand the whole God part, they understand that, and we're I guess it's easier to work with current day science in a certain sense. But what Ramban says is that if we look on the bottom of page 2, second to last line, four words to the end of the line. So he talks about the tohu as being the first material, which is what the Greeks call hyli. After the hyli, he did not create anything, but he formed and made, for from the hyli, he brought forth everything and dressed the forms and fixed them. This is part of his whole idea that the word bara, right, is used four times within the first creation story, because bara is only when something entirely new is created, whereas otherwise it'll use vayitzer, right, he formed. So what he says is this tohu, right, v'ha'aretz haita tohu, is this first amorphous thing that that Hashem created. And again, he's using a Greek philosophical term. Now, even in the 14th century, the Ritva questions whether he was even using this term in the way that traditional philosophers use it, since after all, philosophers believe that the world was always this hyli, as opposed to, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, I might not be, as opposed to saying that it was, meaning it was something that always existed, as opposed to something that God created. But so if Ramban is going to not use the term correctly, then why does he bother using it at all? So again, you know, this shows that he's using the same tactic as Halevi. He will use this term, even if he knows that our approach has a slightly different and a better approach toward what this term means, and he appropriates the term and doesn't use it in the traditional sense of the term. And he does that, as a tactical benefit. If it works, if it helps him explain the Torah, that's fine. Will he change his interpretation of the Torah based on it? No. Torah's Torah. And so this is actually a great example of this kind of usage. Another very famous place where we see the Ramban rejecting a more philosophical or naturalistic interpretation of the Torah is in Parshat Vayera. So we know that the first pasuk in Vayera, this is source number 2 on page 3, says Vayera ilav Hashem be'ilonei mamre, v'hu yoshev petach ha'ohel kachom hayom. So Hashem appeared to Avram in Elonei mamre, and he's sitting in the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. And we know that what happens afterwards is that the three angels come to visit him, and just having a memory of third grade where I got 1 point off a test because, I know it's sad that I remember it, but I wrote three angels as opposed to three people, because my teacher wanted me to write three people because the text says it was three people. It doesn't say it was angels. I haven't recovered from that, I don't think. But anyway, I got the second highest grade in the class. It's okay, 99. So the Rambam on this issue tells us that the whole experience of the angels coming actually didn't really happen. It was all in a vision, okay? And the Ramban, quotes the Rambam from the Moreh Nevuchim and quotes this whole idea, and the Ramban has major problems with this. He says, Here we go. Three lines up from the first paragraph there. According to the Rambam, Sarah did not knead cakes, and Avram did not make meat, and Sarah did not laugh. Everything was a vision. So what was the purpose of showing him all this? Similarly, when it said, Vayavek ish imo, right, about Yaakov when he was fighting with the Malach, the Saro shel Esav, the Rambam says that was all in a vision. And then Ramban has a very good attack on that. He says, well, if it was all a vision, then why was Yaakov limping in the morning? Right? How could it have been a vision if he's limping in the morning? So he says, according to my opinion, this is now the last paragraph, we would have to apply this to the story of Lot. The angels did not come to his house. He did not bake them matzot. They did not eat. Everything was a vision. Even if Lot had ascended to the level of receiving prophecy, have the evil, sinning people of Sodom become prophets? For who told them that the angels came to his house? Because remember, they got all annoyed about that. And the entire section is a vision. And Lot remained in Sodom. And now look at Ramban's attack. He says, these matters contradict the text. It is forbidden to hear them or to believe them. Okay. So Ramban is really anti this more philosophical approach as to what occurred. The concept of angels appearing as humans seems to be philosophically incoherent, but for Ramban, what is more important than whether it's philosophically coherent or not? Does it work with the text? Now, why would the Ramban be so bent on it working with the text? So this really goes to the root of Ramban's hashgafa of how he approaches the Torah. He is one of the pioneers of kind of propelling forward what we know nowadays from the line in the Zohar, Histakel ba'oraita uvara alma, that Hashem looked into the Torah and created the world. In other words, that the Torah is a blueprint for the entire existence and entire world. And therefore, philosophy and mysticism even, and everything, nothing's allowed to contradict the written word of the Torah. So for in this case, in Bereishi Perak Yud Chet, the Ramban can't understand the Rambam's view of prophecy based on this. And it's not that he won't accept philosophy, but that he will never accept philosophy if it goes against the pshat of the Torah. And by the way, where he kind of, in his hakdama to his parish on Bereishit, Ramban tells us that the reason the Torah, this is source number 3 on page 4, the reason the Torah was written in this language is because it preceded the creation of the world, right? There's something important about the Hebrew words themselves. Needless to say, the birth of Moshe, our master. As we receive in our tradition that the Torah was written with black fire on white fire, behold, Moshe is like a scribe who is copying from an existing text. Something existed before our form of Torah. So nothing's allowed to contradict the Torah. Okay. So now we're seeing kind of more of the hashgafic basis for why the Ramban would accept or reject something philosophical. If anyone is interested, I can provide you with some sources regarding the Ramban's participation in the Maimonidean controversy. You might be aware that the Rambam became under severe attack for his rational views. Very famous medieval mefarshim and poskim and you know people who learned vehemently attacked him. There even was a book burning, right? Jews burned the books of the Rambam. Rabbeinu Yonah of Gerona, who was a cousin of the Ramban, was an anti Maimonidean, and he was involved in the book burning. And then a few years later, there was, of course, the big book burning. The church burned burned the Talmud, and Rabbeinu Yonah saw that as punishment for the fact that they had burned the Rambam's books, and he apparently traveled to Eretz Yisrael to pray at the Rambam's grave for forgiveness for having done that. So it was a very heated issue of the time. What he says there and the way that he actually defends the Rambam despite his issues with the Rambam is important in terms of understanding his relationship with the more philosophical tradition. So now we're seeing there are some nuances to Hirsch's general idea that Halevi and Ramban were similarly cautious to the outside and preferred to work from within. Again, Halevi remains kind of ambivalent as to how he views philosophy. And even though Ramban often accepts philosophical ideas, He will reject it if at any point it undermines Kedushat HaTorah. In a certain sense, you can see that he perhaps picked up where Halevi left off. And he's almost a little less self-conscious about his opinions than Halevi is. So you could say that Halevi fought the skeptic's battle, and maybe he never fully recovered, whereas Ramban inherited a much safer approach toward philosophical inquiry, and it wasn't as fraught with the tension that Halevi had to deal with. So let's see whether I'm going to... I'm going to talk about Kabbalah for just a minute, that Halevi, just you should know that the whole emergence of what we know as Kabbalah, according to scholars, this is something that is clearly that a lot of people have heated ideas about this, but according to the more academic view, which I think is completely a hushkafically acceptable thing to accept, the academics kind of see the emergence of Kabbalah as occurring in the 13th century. I mentioned before Rav Yitzchak Sagi Nahor as one of the more important people in this process, and Halevi preceded this. So Halevi did not have a more systematic approach toward mysticism, which is why, as I mentioned, he very often rejected it. Whereas Ramban was involved in kind of putting it together. He was in this, as I mentioned before, elite group of people who were trying to kind of figure out what mysticism was all about. I just want to point out, I don't want to spend too much time on this because I'm not 40 yet, and also because I think a lot of people will be like, I didn't understand what active intellect meant, I don't think I'm going to understand this stuff. I do want you to be in general aware that they're both considered to be conservative mystics. I want to give one example of Ramban as a conservative mystic. When it comes to what we call the Isser Arayot, the prohibition of someone to marry or have relations with someone who's a relative in particular, Ramban quotes the Rambam. The Rambam says, why is it that you're not allowed to have relations with a relative? Well, it's to minimize intercourse. This is on page 4, source 6, and to be disgusted with it, that in itself, another shear, and settle for only a little of it. And these women, who the text prohibits, it is because they are around a man at all times. They're too accessible. And this, so by the way, then the dot 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 is Ibn Ezra saying the same thing. So we see the philosophical approach is, why would the Torah say you can't, that particular relations are forbidden? It's because they're around too much. And Ramban doesn't like this. He says this is a very weak reason that the text would require karet, right, spiritual excision for these women since they're around, but he would permit a person to marry hundreds of thousands of women. What would be harmful about him marrying only his daughter, as Noahides are permitted to do? Or to marry two sisters like Yaakov? And isn't the world created not to return to nil, but to inhabit it? Meaning, why should anything get in the way of our commandment? The first thing we see in the Torah is pru or uvu. So shouldn't you be able to marry whoever's nearby and whoever's around? Anyway, so Ramban says, though, this is a very famous line of the Ramban, Ve'ein biyadeinu davar mekubal bazeh. We do not have a tradition on this. But according to logic, there is some secret of creation in it about the soul, and it is part of the secret of the transmigration of souls that I have hinted to, the Sod Ha'ibur. So what's he doing here? He's saying, logically, where should we turn if we want to understand who you can marry and who you can't marry? Kabbalah, right? That would be logic, because clearly it has something to do with souls. But what does he say? I don't have a tradition on this. It's logical to go in that direction, but I don't have a Mesorah. His Rebbe in Kabbalah was named Rabbi Yehuda ben Yakar, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Yakar had not taught him anything on this issue. So he couldn't make anything up. He couldn't try to figure out how this would relate to the concept of transmigration of the souls. If you want to look for someone who does go in that direction, his name was the Rekanadi. So you can look up. He talks about that, and it goes all mystical. And in fact, Ramban knew about a letter that Rav Yitzchak Sagi Nahor wrote to his contemporaries named Rav Ezra and Ravenu Azriel, who he admonished for revealing too many secrets of the Kabbalah. So we see that even though we think of Kabbalah and a Kabbalistic understanding of the Torah, and we think, oh, Ramban, he was actually one of the most conservative. And again, perhaps we can see him as being a kindred spirit to Halevi, who was also, you know, things really had to be traditional in order to make it on. Okay. This one's fun. That at the bottom of page 4 in his treatise called Torah Hashem Tamima, Ramban even mentions that he sees in the Torah where it mentions Maaseh Breishit, the science of creation, right? That's the beginning of Breishit. But he says, I don't understand where the Torah is alluding to Maaseh Merkava. What is Maaseh Merkava? That's the sixth chapter of Yeshayahu, the first two chapters of Yechezkel. There are others, theophanies scattered throughout where you see these experiences of the celestial world. So Ramban actually points out that it's kind of weird because in the Torah, well, there's around Har Sinai, there's like a little something, but there's really no mention of some kind of theosophic experience. And therefore, he says perhaps there was an oral esoteric tradition which reached to the time when Yechezkel and Yeshayahu came and linked it to the biblical verses. But again, he's a little nervous. Like, where do we even get our mystical tradition from? So we can see him as a conservative Kabbalist. Okay. Moving on to Hashgacha Pratit, divine intervention. What I want to show you here is that this is a place where Ramban develops a very usable approach toward divine intervention, where Halevi couldn't kind of find a very comfortable approach. In part 4, the Kuzari says, why do we need any other explanations to explain how multiplicity emanated from a unique God? Let us simply acknowledge that everything occurs through God's will, that the universe was created from nothing, that God created all the diverse items in the universe simultaneously, each according to its kind, as recorded in the Torah's accounts of creation. He placed within each component the ability to subsist and reproduce. God constantly maintains them with his divine power, as we say in our liturgy, HaMechadesh B'tuvo B'chol Yom Tamid Maaseh Breishit, right? He renews in his goodness daily the acts of creation. And that's what the Melech HaKozarim said. And now the rabbi says, you speak well, Kezar King. What you say is true in the correct belief, and we should forsake that which is unnecessary, right? Let's take the razor and knock off any kind of approach toward how Hashem acts in this world. And yeah, let's just accept that. So that seems to be his approach there. However, in part 5, the beginning of part 5, he says, the Kuzari says, can you just tell me some sound and rational lessons about the fundamentals of faith? And in part 5, he seems to actually be saying things at the beginning in the first 18 sections that he might not necessarily agree with, but that seem to be what people think. But then in part 19, the Melech says, can you just tell me what you think? Okay, thank you for giving me what a lot of other people think. Can you tell me what you think? And what Halevi goes on to say is that there are different ways to explain Hashgacha Pratzit. He says, one person can truthfully say, I'm on the middle of page 5, that all things happen through human decision and circumstance. He can say it without removing these things from God's control. If you wish, you can make this more understandable with the following categorization. All phenomena are either divine, natural, incidental, or chosen. And he explains that divine things are things that come directly from Hashem. Natural things occur through intermediaries, but they're still from Hashem. Incidental things are less organized, but they're still from Hashem. And chosen events are bechira chofshit, what humans decide to do and seem to be less connected with what Hashem has decided or not. But he says all of these things can be directly related back to Hashem. And he says, though, he goes on to say that if you don't have this idea of intermediaries, if you don't have this idea that not everything is directly coming from Hashem, then miracles have no importance anymore, right? If everything is just always a miracle, everything is always this, you know, overt miracle, then nothing special. No event, no moment. Kriyat Yam Suf is just as monumental as me standing here today. We've taken the value of miracles away. And so that's what leaves him to say, well, there's indirect cause and there's direct cause. But he's not comfortable. We can see that Halevi's not fully comfortable with what he's saying, because he's taking things, he's distancing things from Hashem. Ramban has a much, and people say because of his acceptance of Kabbalah, has a much more, workable understanding of things. And people are very familiar with Ramban's famous approach, which we can see on page 6, that he distinguishes between what are considered covert miracles and overt miracles, right? That, and the job of the revealed miracles, from the revealed large miracles, like Kriyat Yamsuf, like Matan Torah, man comes to admit that even the hidden miracles, which are the foundation of the entire Torah, right, that he comes to understand and to accept that everything is really miraculous. Because you cannot have a portion in Moshe's Torah until you believe that everything truly is a miracle. There's nothing natural. Okay, so we see that Halevi didn't want to see things as not natural, because then miracles are no longer important. But Ramban is saying nothing is natural in this world. And he's able to say it because he says, well, there's a difference between something that's a revealed miracle and something that's a hidden miracle. But this is a pretty intense approach towards life, and the philosophical term for this approach is called occasionalism. This is an occasionalist viewpoint. And on your own, just because we're kind of short on time, you can see that Ramban, in source 5 that I brought here, kind of sets up his the underpinnings for why he approaches things this way. So again, we see that where Halevi remained stuck, Ramban was freed and able to accept occasionalism. Different scholars mentioned that there were Arabic scholars who at the time also believed in this concept of occasionalism, but Ramban believed, but the one of the famous Ramban scholars named Henoch, he believes that Ramban's source for this idea was truly in Kabbalah and not external. And that it's very much, if you read the Torah, his approach makes a lot of sense. We associate this viewpoint also with Rav Eliyahu Dessler, who lived in the 20th century and popularized this approach as well. So one scholar named Bezalel Safran noticed that there actually might be a direct connection between Ramban and Halevi on this issue, because if you look at Ramban's introduction to Iyov, he uses a phrase which was popularized by Halevi, and this phrase is the Inyan Eloki. And he says that the force of the wind to knock down the house upon the sons, remember Eov's sons get, killed off in the first chapter, is as if it was nature, and this is Inyan Eloki, the divine essence. Okay, so it's as if it's nature, but you can't possibly see it as purely nature, it has to be something divine. Now, why is that so important? Because this phrase of Inyan Eloki is a Halevi phrase. And if you look at the sources that I brought for this third section, which is where we're going to see Halevi and Ramban actually go on different paths, the Kuzari develops this idea, and we'll define the Inyan Eloki as this divine presence or divine essence. And he says that's why B'nai Yisrael are unique. B'nai Yisrael are unique because we have this divine essence in us. No other nation has it. He spends time explaining how, this Inyan Eloki was passed down from Adam to Shem to Enosh to Noach to Shem, Eber, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Moshe, and only at Yaakov did this Inyan Eloki get passed down, not just to one individual, but to 12. And he says most of these children, I'm in the middle of source 2 within on page 6, that most of the children were like the peel of a fruit, not attaining their father's level, since they did not possess the same divine qualities. And this was true until Yaakov. And that's why the Inyan Eloki is also present in Eretz Yisrael. That's why Israel is more important than any other location. It should not be difficult to understand, source number 3, how one land can be more distinguished than others. You yourself see how one place produces a certain type of plant more successfully than other places, or is richer in a certain mineral, or better for a certain kind of livestock. And he says that he goes on and explains that more in depth, and even mentions that any time there's nevuah, it's either in Eretz Yisrael or about Eretz Yisrael. So he is probably, he's the first real Well, he's the most important Zionist from the medieval period. And we know that Ramban also follows in his footsteps for being pretty, shall we say, obsessed with Eretz Yisrael. And in Lech Lecha, in explaining how, the famous question of how Avram Avinu knew to go to Eretz Yisrael without being told to do that, right? He just went. He wasn't told where he's going, but somehow he just went towards Eretz Yisrael. So Ramban has two explanations in his Parashat HaTorah. In his first explanation, he says the reason he went, that the reason he knew to go is because that's where they were going anyway, right? He and his father intended to go to Canaan, not because of God telling them to, but they actually were already on their way out of the house. But then, in the middle of page 7, it says, V'yitachein lomar. He ventures, he suggests a second explanation. He says it's possible that somehow he saw Eretz Yisrael as a spiritual magnet, right? That he knew from the start that Canaan was Hashem's inheritance and that Hashem would give him a portion there. That El Ha'aretz Asher Ar'eka, he understood spiritually as being Eretz Yisrael. Now, why is it so important that it says V'yitachein lomar? So this is an idea that I heard from my professor in college, Dr. Mordechai Cohen. He said that he's not fully comfortable with it. He's like, well, maybe you could say that Eretz Yisrael was a spiritual magnet. Now, what gives us the permission to obsess with the words it is possible to say? Because if you look at Ramban's discourse on the words of Kohelet, he mentions, he doesn't give two answers. He doesn't say it's possible to say, but he gives us the only explanation for why Avram Avinu knew to go to Eretz Yisrael was that it was the distinction of the land of Israel that bestirred our father Avram to go of his own accord to the land of Canaan. Keep in mind that Canaan at the time was not a very spiritual place. It was teeming with idolatry and terrible things going on. And the fact that Avram Avinu had this magnet towards, you know, that there was a magnet drawing him there is significant. Now, I would like to suggest that the Kuzari is the one who actually said this idea first, right? Where does he say it? He says it in part 2. This is the bottom of page 7. First of all, I highly recommend reading all of the things that the Kuzari does here, where he lists all of these wonderful Talmudic statements about the importance of Eretz Yisrael, that you can be forced to move to Eretz Yisrael, but you can't be forced to leave Eretz Yisrael. A woman who does not wish to immigrate to Eretz Yisrael may be divorced without her ketubah, whereas if a woman wants to leave and make aliyah, but the husband doesn't want to go with her, then he must divorce her and give her her ketubah. It is better to live in Eretz Yisrael, even in a city which is mostly not Jewish, than to live outside of Eretz Yisrael, even in a city that is mostly Jewish. I don't know any cities like that. For anyone who dwells in Eretz Yisrael is like someone who has a god. And anyone who dwells outside of Eretz Yisrael is like someone who has no god. And I wrote in on and on and on because he has like 400 other things that he has to say about the importance of Eretz Yisrael and the superiority of Eretz Yisrael. And then I brought this because it's just an amazing moment. Then the Kuzari says, well, then you're not in the right place. You're not in Eretz Yisrael. And then the Kuzari says, when I put in bold, your forefathers chose to live in Eretz Yisrael rather than in their birthplaces. They even preferred a life wandering in Eretz Yisrael over a settled life in their homelands. This was their choice, despite the fact that the divine presence had not yet been seen there. Right? Indeed, the land at the time was teeming with immorality and idolatry, as I mentioned. Nevertheless, their only desire was to dwell there. There was something drawing them to Eretz Yisrael. So we can see, perhaps, who may have influenced this idea? Halevi may have influenced Ramban. Just to give a little historical boost to this theory, his discourse on Kohelet is an interesting discourse. He starts out, and for a good while, he's actually talking about the book of Kohelet, and then he kind of gets sick of it and stops talking about it, and the rest of his treatise on Kohelet is all about Eretz Yisrael and giving tzedakah, and he completely goes off topic. And the historical evidence is that he gave this 2 years after he was involved in the disputations, and he was in a very dangerous spot. The Christian friars, the Dominican friars, were trying to kick him out of Gerona and send him away. And the king was actually considering expelling Ramban, and he was kind of nervous. And this was around Sukkot time. And so you can almost you know, see that he is nervous. And in the end, he was kicked out for a short time, and I believe, and he was allowed to come back. But it's interesting. I would presume that during the time of the disputations, very good reading to look up and to kind of refresh his mind for would be the Khuzari, right? Because the Khuzari is the defense of the despised nation. So when he went to battle the Christians as to the acceptability and the truth of Yahadut, it would make a lot of sense if he were to read the Khuzari again. And it was kind of fresh in his mind and may have influenced. And that's why perhaps when he's giving his perush in Kohelet, he's just like, this is why. Eretz Yisrael is a spiritual magnet. So, and then you see that in part 24, the Chaver responds, you have shamed me, king of the Khuzari, of Khuzar. And he talks about how we failed to do a full return to Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Second Temple and preferred subservience in the diaspora so that they would not have to part from their homes and affairs. He said it, not me. Now, what's interesting, though, is that we do know that at the end of the Khuzari, he famously leaves the Melech HaKhuzarim and he makes Aliyah. Halevi, in his own life, the legend says that he made Aliyah, and as soon as he arrived, what happened to him? He was trampled by an Arab horseman. We don't know if that was true, but even just the idea that someone who loved Eretz Yisrael so much, that that's the story we tell of him, that tragic story, just represents just how much he yearned for Eretz Yisrael. Now, so that's a case where we can see a connection between the two. However, that mention of Inyan Eloki in his introduction to Iyov, in his commentary on Iyov, is maybe the only mention of Inyan Eloki in all of Ramban. He doesn't use that terminology. And the question is why? And this will take me just 3 more minutes, so if you could bear with me. There is one area where there seems to be a very big difference between how Ramban approaches things and how the Khuzari approaches things. And that is the question of whether Am Yisrael is unique l'chatchila, right? Ideally they are unique, or only as a bidiavad, only as a concession to the frailty of human nature. So Halevi says it's a lechatzchila, right? It makes sense that one thing would be superior over other things. And I think that, you know, this is a point in the Khuzari that makes a lot of people uncomfortable in terms of how we understand what it means to be Am Segula. This is a very difficult, it seems, I dare say, a little bit of a racist approach toward why we have a different mission in life. And Ramban actually seems to perhaps reject this approach. And in his parish in Devarim, in Perek Lamed Bet, Pasuk Chafav, he says that Hashem created man in the lower world so that he would recognize his creator and be grateful to his name. And he put the permission to do good or bad in his hands. And when they sinned willingly and all denied Hashem, only this nation remained in his name. And through them he publicized, through signs and wonders, that he is the God of all powers and master of all masters. And that's why he couldn't destroy us. And he had to have one nation to be closer because the others failed. But what are we seeing for Ramban? Is it ideal? Does he want it to be? That all of the other peels, everything else would be a peel to the fruit? If you read Bereishit very, very seriously, it actually seems the opposite. Hashem started out, he wanted everybody to know Hashem on the same level. He tried. He set up the world in that way. But Ramban's right. Didn't work out. He had to try again with Noach. Didn't even work out then. Even the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach wasn't enough to really reach the level of moral excellence that he expected out of us. And that's why, as a concession to the frailty of human nature, we're the ones who have to, you know, have a more specific approach. But we see here that in his essence, Ramban is more akin to the Rambam on this issue, the Rambam who was a little bit more of a universalist, right, and not a particularist like the Khuzari. And perhaps that could explain why, even though there's so many similarities and things in common between Ramban and Halevi, he doesn't use this very famous terminology of the Khuzari, the idea of the Inyan Eloki. So I think we've seen today that the broad pictures of Halevi and Ramban are very similar, right? They are Jewish leaders. They are cautious of the outside. They only use philosophy and science where it augments the understanding and the thinks Tziv Torah, even from within the Jewish tradition, they're very cautious in how, and they're very conservative in how they interpret things. And it's possible to see that even though Halevi came before Kabbalah, perhaps his approach, his hashkafa, was a model upon which Ramban based his own acceptance or rejection of Kabbalistic ideas. And perhaps and by the way, I didn't mention that there's one particular area where Halevi does, where Ramban does quote Halevi, and that's when talking about the concept of Dveikut, of cleaving to Hashem, he quotes Halevi directly, so we could do that another time. And we've seen that with divine intervention, there were issues that kind of remained difficult for Halevi, and his approach towards it wasn't complete, whereas Ramban, perhaps a recipient of Halevi's tradition, was able to come up with a much more satisfying and clear approach toward that same issue. And then we saw the one area we saw that Halevi brought to the front and center of the medieval thought, the importance of Eretz Yisrael, and that Ramban seemed to follow in his footsteps. But then there's this one little difference where Ramban does seem to see the idea of being an Am Segula as not something that was ideal, but perhaps a concession to human frailty. So now that we see that Rav Hirsch's analysis of Halevi and Ramban is a little bit under question here, the question is it under question or not? Right? Do these more nuanced views of both of these individuals demote their status as representing what Rav Hirsch called as the authentic voice of Judaism? I believe that it's to the contrary. In fact, you look deeper, and I think it promotes this being the authentic voice of Judaism. That the authentic voice of Judaism is something that resides in someone who is deeply, deeply steeped in tradition, who embraces and transcends the challenges and contradictions of the times in which he lives. And I truly bless us that that as a community, we should follow in Halevi and Ramban and Rav Hirsch's footsteps, and we should all be zochot with our families to a complete and authentic and inspired life of Torah in Eretz Yisrael.
Because of the time, if you have any questions, I'm sure that Atara would be happy to address them individually. For those of you who walked in late, I just want to reiterate that there are going to be some changes to the schedule for the rest of the year. We are going to have Ms. Miriam Krupka speak next month, March 27th. And then we're very excited to have Dr. Erica Brown come on May 1st, and that's going to be a special Midrash Yom Rishon program from 10 to 12. And more details will follow, as well as Rabbi Moshe Targan, as I announced last month. He will be our Shavuot scholar in residence, and that will, you know, bring the details will be available closer to Yom Tov. Thank you so much, Atara, for sharing your Torah with us. Also, I failed to mention that this month's shiur was very generously sponsored by Caroline Hofstadter Digger. So thank you so much, and we hope that you will join us next month. And please approach Atara with any questions that you may have. Thank you.